This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. The intersection of what? The intersection of politics and culture. Thank you so much for being with us for this episode of my podcast. And we're going to take a look at three presidential candidates. But we're not going to do it the way everybody else does. Everybody else has a tendency to look at these candidates in terms of a horse race. Who's in front? Who's polling well? Who's raising funds? That's not what I'm looking at. We're going to look at these three, and then we're going to look at some other ones in successive episodes. People like billionaires, Mike Bloomberg, Howard Schultz, that sort of thing. People who are grouped together one way or the other. So we're looking at three candidates today. We're looking at Kamala Harris. We're looking at Cory Booker. And we're looking at Pete Buttigieg. And we're looking at them for a specific set of reasons. First, of course, if Kamala Harris is elected, she'd be the first female, and Cory Booker, if he's elected, would be the second black president, and Pete Buttigieg, who, by the way, is the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, if you don't know, would be the first gay president. So let's look at these folks and look at their chances given those realities. Let's talk first about Kamala Harris. In addition to being black and female, she has a white husband. And you have to ask yourself, is America truly ready for that? Now, we ought to say as a given that America has made some extraordinary progress through the years as regards race relations, as regards fighting sexism, as regards a number of different issues that in my lifetime as a young person were more or less givens, and they've changed. They have, in fact, changed. And we'll talk about that later on during the podcast. But is America, first of all, truly ready for a female president? I'm not so sure. I have maintained from day one that Hillary Clinton lost the election in part, not in total, but in part, because there was a segment of the American public that simply would not vote for a woman. Now, she lost for a number of other reasons, part of which had to do with the fact that people didn't trust her, people didn't like her, all of those sorts of things. But would Kamala Harris have to overcome the notion that people do not want a female president? Then the question is, of course, she's black. And if she were elected, she'd be the second black president. And thirdly, would she have a handicap because her husband is not black? Would black people criticize her for marrying outside the race? Now, that may sound absurd to some people, but I got to tell you, folks, when they get behind closed doors, folks, when they get among like-minded people, these are the kinds of things that they might discuss. Don't think for a moment that we've become a non-racial society simply because we elected Barack Obama, because, after all, who did we elect right after Barack Obama? I think there is a reluctance on the part of some people to vote for a woman. I think there is a reluctance among some people to vote for a candidate that has a husband that is not of the same race. Now, I'm not saying it's right. Let's be very clear about that. In a fair and just America, in the America that I would love to see happen in my lifetime, I know that these would not be the barriers that I think they are. But I do think they are because America has got a long way to go to get to that point where people are judged, as Martin Luther King said, by the content of their character. We don't always do that. And I think in Kamala Harris's case, she may, aside from policy positions, because see, people are going to criticize her, and people are going to criticize all three of the people that we're talking about today. They're going to criticize them based on policy positions, their positions on certain issues, where they get their funds from, all of that. That's a given. But I didn't want to focus on that because that turns things into a horse race. And there's enough horse race politics to last a lifetime, as far as I'm concerned. Now, if you keep in mind that each of these politicians that we're talking about have their own strengths and weaknesses politically, Kamala Harris certainly has a decent shot. It's remaining to be seen. It is truly remaining to be seen. Because the bottom line is, there may be people who see her interracial marriage and her womanness, for want of a better term, as obstacles or as something that would be a deal breaker in terms of their ability to vote for her. Next up, Cory Booker. Cory Booker would be the first bachelor elected president since Grover Cleveland in the 1880s. And he would certainly be the second black president. Would America be ready to elect a black man so soon after Barack Obama? After all, we're only talking about 4 years. Time is going to tell. Cory Booker has a number of things going for him. And again, staying away from policy positions for the moment, Cory Booker is an extraordinary speaker. He is a very personable politician. He has a certain charisma. I've seen it myself. I've interviewed him, certainly when he was mayor of Newark, and I believe once or twice after he was elected to the Senate. But I have seen that extraordinary charisma and his ability to bond with people. And people that may not totally agree with him on policy positions. I've seen it in when he's spoken to crowds. And I have to say, on a personal note, my daughter is a big fan of Cory Booker. My daughter's going on 22 years old. If he can hit the youth vote, and remember that he's 49, I think, going on 50, which makes him relatively young among the candidates that have announced thus far, it could be. I'm not saying for certain, but it could be something that works positively in his favor. The bachelor thing, I don't know. You know, there have been persistent slurs against Cory Booker going back to when he first ran for mayor, that he was gay, that he was this, he was that. One of his opponents, who was an incumbent mayor at the time, actually went public with the allegation that Cory Booker was gay. I'm not here to talk about whether he is or whether he isn't. He certainly is not openly gay, and I've seen him in enough situations for me to conclude that he's actually heterosexual. But you see, these are the things that people talk about in terms of candidates. I remember, I was very, very young at the time, but I remember when John Kennedy ran for the presidency in 1960, and my parents would sit and talk about some of the pros and cons of John Kennedy versus Richard Nixon, who was the vice president at the time. And my parents would talk about whether or not there was an issue with his being Catholic. See, because there was this notion, and it was something that crushed Al Smith when he ran for president back in 1928, this notion that a Catholic's first allegiance would not be to the country, but would in fact be to the papacy, to the Pope. And there was all this sturm and drawing about that. And as it turned out, John Kennedy won anyway. And there's a strain of, and certainly, you know, Cory Booker, I don't even know what his religion is, and that's not really the issue here. The issue is he the kind of person that will bond with non-millennials, with older people? Now, again, I've seen him in situations where he's done extremely well that way. But there is a question as to whether or not he has that kind of charisma. And of course, I'll say it again, there is the question of his position on issues, but we're not going to get into that. To me, the question is America ready now, after having elected who we elected in 2016, is America ready for a second black president? I don't know. Time is going to tell, both with Kamala Harris and with Cory Booker. I would be very interested, by the way, to see how Kamala Harris handles herself. She's been on television a few times. I saw a video of her the other day where she talked about her favorite songs for this and that and what lifts her spirits, et cetera, et cetera. That's cool, if that's how you want to spend your time. I'm not at all sure that was particularly compelling, and I don't think it would be compelling if Cory Booker did it either. I'm interested, in fact, assuming that they are ideologically similar, how they interact with each other within the confines of the United States Senate. We don't know yet. I don't know what attack lines they would use against each other. I don't know whether the Senate is a relatively collegial body, so it would be interesting to see how that will work itself out. Our third candidate is Pete Buttigieg. He's the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and the only openly gay candidate to have announced thus far. He's also 37 years old, which is only 2 years above the minimum age to become president of the United States. Can an openly gay person, openly gay candidate, win the highest office in the land? Again, in a just, in a fair America, this would not be a question. This would not be an issue. But we don't live in an ultimately fair and just America. And there are going to be people saying, I'm not voting for no gay guy. And all of us, all of you listening to this podcast, know people who think that way and who would, in an unguarded moment, let you know that they think that way. In terms of his personal situation, apparently he has a husband, has been married, and, you know, they're living happily ever after, I would assume. But there are going to be people who have a problem with that. Now, I have to say, I don't, okay, as a person who attended a church with an openly gay priest, and I say it's an Episcopal church, and just in case you think it's Catholic, I have no problem with it whatsoever, because to me, one's sexuality has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with their competence, to do with their intelligence, and to their ability to do their job. We will see if there are people who agree with me that that should not be a deal breaker in terms of a candidacy for the presidency. Is Pete Buttigieg perhaps reaching too high for someone who has very little name recognition across the country? He did get a couple of TV shots. I believe he was on The View and maybe someplace else. But does he have the name recognition to, in fact, come out of nowhere and snare the Democratic nomination for the presidency? Because it is going to be out of nowhere. Most people know where South Bend, Indiana is primarily because of Notre Dame, the football team, at this point their basketball team. It is a town that is known for its Catholic, I should say, university. That doesn't mean that South Bend is somehow dominated by Catholics. It doesn't mean that at all. Maybe it is, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. But in the public mind, that's, you know, that's why people know South Bend. And here's a mayor who is openly gay. Now, that is an accomplishment in and of itself in a town that is known for its Catholic university. I'll give him all the credit in the world for that. But can he take that appeal and spread it out? Can he in some way perhaps get people to look beyond, if that's necessary, to look beyond the fact that he's gay? Again, for me, I don't care. I would not, I would feel almost insulted if somebody said to me, well, you have to look beyond his gayness. I think that's absurd. But we live in America. We live in 2018-19, and we are right now in a situation where many, many things that I thought were done and dusted in American life have suddenly come back to life and have scared the living bejesus, at least out of me, because I thought we had fought and won certain battles that we have not. And I think Pete Buttigieg is going to find out that his battle is going to be to convince an electorate that is not homophobic. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying all Americans are homophobic, but I think that it would be an issue that would be used against him, maybe even in a primary, in primary states. Not, never mind the Republicans. The Republicans would just go do back over flips about it. But I think in the context of what we're looking at, even in the Democratic Party, it could be one of those whispering sorts of things. And don't think for an instant that Democrats don't whisper, and that's the sole province of the Republican Party. Republicans will open their mouths about certain things. Democrats, sometimes they just go zip, 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 and try to have the same effect without making it public. We're going to take a break. This is The Intersection. My name is Mark Riley. When we come back, are presidents chosen by God? And the Lord truly works in mysterious ways. Please stay with us.
You're listening to The Intersection of Politics and Culture with Mark Riley.
Are presidents chosen by God? Yes, I'm sure most of you by now have heard that White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders believes just that. I called her in the notes here a presidential mouthpiece, and I guess that is pretty much what she is. She told an interviewer on the Christian Broadcasting Network the following, and this is a direct quote. I think he, talking about God, wanted Donald Trump to become president, and that's why he's here. Now, end quote, by the way. Ordinarily, this would be good for a few laughs and a pretty fair bit of derision. It's almost as funny as Mitch McConnell saying trying to make Election Day a federal holiday is some sort of Democratic plot. But the fact of the matter is, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, I think, believes what she says, even though it flies in the face of logic, even though it flies in the face of a whole heck of a lot. For example, is it possible that if God chose Donald Trump, God also chose Barack Obama or George W. Bush or Bill Clinton or any of the other previous presidents, living or dead? Did God choose them? Why did God choose only Donald Trump? Assuming that's what Sarah Huckabee Sanders believes. And you think she might be alone in this belief? She's certainly one of the few people within the Trump ambit that have said this particular thing publicly, that God wanted Donald Trump. However, her views are shared by a surprising number of white evangelical Christians. In point of fact, a poll from 2017 found that 57%, that is, by my math, and I wasn't good at it, more than half, believe that God actually wanted Donald Trump to win the 2016 election, and that God actually played a major role in the outcome of the 2016 election. Now, you know, anything's possible, but it would seem to be totally incongruous. Evangelical Christians supporting a thrice-married hedonist like our current president. And I don't have to go through all of the different back and forth and what he did and what he said, and not, you know, stuff that he could deny, stuff that was on tape. So how do white evangelicals, and I'm sure there are a few black evangelicals as well, how do they suspend their belief systems about right, wrong, heaven, hell, et cetera, to support this guy? I don't understand how that makes sense to anybody. But there is, apparently, a subset of evangelism that believes in prophecy and God's complete omnipotence. And generally, they're called charismatic Christians. Something like 80% backed Donald Trump in 2016. That's 80. Now, you can, as some pundits, both right-wing and left-wing, to be fair, have posited that Sanders was just plain wrong. And they will go chapter and verse and cite scripture and, you know, go into a factual deep dive about what Sarah Huckabee Sanders said and say, it doesn't make any sense. And maybe on that level, it doesn't. But you see, to white evangelicals, it does make sense. It makes perfect sense. It makes no difference to Sarah Huckabee Sanders or to people who believe it as she does, whether people believe in them, whether people believe they're wrong or not. They don't care. Many people in this cohort think that their religious freedoms, whatever they may think they are, like banning abortions, hating gays, whatever, that those freedoms are being infringed upon. They have had court judgments that have said that as Christians or whatever they are and however they describe themselves, that they have a right to discriminate against people, to say no to people, and they'll cloak it in all kinds of flowery language, sugar-coated with, oh, no, we don't hate gays, and no, we don't, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But the fact of the matter is, these folks somehow gain strength and sustenance from saying no to people. Just going, no, 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 no. No to gays, no to abortion, no to all of these things that other Americans have, at this point, gotten used to. But they have never given up. And I guess they see in Donald Trump, no matter what his past, and again, I would commend the late, great Wayne Barrett's book, if you want to know what Donald Trump is really all about, that doesn't matter to these people. They do not care one way or the other. They are perfectly happy with Donald Trump as he is because he supports issues that they support. Now, you have to be clear about one thing. Back, God, it was a long time ago now, but back when George W. Bush was seeking re-election in 2004, he made a lot of promises, through Karl Rove, I might add, to the evangelical community. He was one of them. He believed in this, he believed in that, he believed in the other. And Karl Rove later said, after the election was over, he was just yanking their chain. Evangelical Christians have not forgotten that. They have not forgotten how they thought somebody was one of them, and it turns out they absolutely were not. Donald Trump, with all his faults, and when I say faults, I'm talking about faults according to evangelical Christians, things that they would not tell their own flock to do, as a matter of fact. With all of that, they do believe that he will make good on certain promises. See, evangelicals care about who becomes a federal judge, who sits on the United States Supreme Court. Why? Because those are the people that will be able to enact certain doctrines that they wholeheartedly believe in. The Supreme Court has said, no, if you have certain religious beliefs, you don't have to serve gay people. The Supreme Court seems to be on a track to say, no, women do not have the right to choose. And they credit Donald Trump for creating the judicial milieu for many of their biggest and most serious priorities to be addressed. And as long as that is the case, as long as people believe that Donald Trump is with them in these very visceral ways, then they'll support him. It wouldn't matter to them if he divorced Melania in office and married somebody else. Doesn't matter. Because he supports their beliefs. He supports, he's got their back, in point of fact. And they have gone through and lived through situations where Republican presidents have said they stood with them and then backed out and then did not do what they said they were going to do. This is the difficulty here for them. I mean, it's certainly not a difficulty for me. That, I think, maybe explains how evangelicals can support a guy like Donald Trump. But at the same time, as these evangelical Christians trumpet what they trumpet, halfway around the world, a different type of Christianity was practiced. And unless you read The Guardian, you probably would not have heard much, if anything, about it. And maybe God stepped in here just like he stepped in to elect Donald Trump. Whether you agree or disagree, let's have that conversation. Post your comments on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. There's a place called the Bethel Church in The Hague, the Netherlands. They performed a church service for 96 consecutive days. That's right, a church service for 96 consecutive days. Why, you might ask? To shield an Armenian family from deportation from the Netherlands. They said they feared they'd be in danger if they were returned to Armenia. The husband is a political activist. The church, which is located in The Hague, relied on a medieval law that says immigration authorities could not enter a church while a service was being performed. So, of course, if the immigration people were serious, or if this was the United States, they'd just wait till the service ended, and then they'd go in and snatch who they wanted. Well, the solution to that for the Bethel Church was to hold services continuously for 96 days. 96 days straight. That is extraordinary. And to me, reflective of a religious belief that I have, you know, that you offer shelter to people who need it. And these folks did that, and they not only let them in the church, but they created a situation where the immigration authorities could not come in and take them out. And after that 96 days worth of church services, the Dutch government granted the family amnesty. And by the way, this is not some, as they say, far left. You hear a lot of that now since Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. This is not a far left government. This is a center right coalition government. And immigration, as it were, is a hot button issue, as it is throughout Western Europe. But this is a happy ending. As a Christian, I feel this is a happy ending. And the highest calling of Christianity, to use a law that says you cannot enter a church and take people out while there is a service going on, and the solution is to say, well, we'll just have services. We will just continue having services until the government changes its mind about deporting these people. And it's not just them. Apparently, there's some a fair number, about 600-odd people in the Netherlands who are likely to be granted amnesty. Of course, amnesty here in the States is a four-letter word. Even though the one person who granted amnesty was a Republican president, people forget this, Ronald Reagan, but the fact of the matter is people use amnesty as an epithet when it comes to immigration in 2019. And by the way, have been using it that way for some time. The Republicans have seized on this as a wedge issue. They have attempted, with varying degrees of success, to try and get groups like African-Americans to say immigrants are harmful, immigrants take our jobs, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, Donald Trump has elevated this, or actually lowered this, into saying that, you know, they're rapists, they're murderers, they're this, they're that, they're the other. It's all such nonsense. But if you want to see, in my judgment, an example of the highest calling of Christianity, the highest calling of Christianity, you need look no further than the Bethel Church in The Hague, because they took a family in and kept them safe from deportation until the government, a center-right government, coalition government, but a center-right government, said, okay, they can stay. That, to me, is, and when you contrast this with what's happening here, where children who are trying to cross the border end up dead, two of them, it to me, is a stark contrast. And a stark contrast between that and somebody saying that God wanted Donald Trump to be president, which is what his press secretary has in fact turned around and said. The differences are so stark as to be almost laughable to me that we have two. And again, you know, this is Western civilization. This didn't happen someplace that America has a problem with or doesn't think is as civilized as we are. This happened in Western Europe. And thank God, I think, that it did. What action are you taking looking at the 2020 election? Email me at mark@markreillymedia.com. I'd love to hear from you on my Facebook page, Mark Reilly Media. Whether you agree with me or disagree, and I got to be clear about something. I know a lot of people who I am very close to who disagree with me about what time of day it is politically. It's all good as far as I'm concerned. You know, I've had people attack me in the past saying, you know, how can you be friendly with people who think so differently than you? I believe that, and it's just for me, I'm not saying this is, you know, necessarily the case. Maybe everybody else that thinks like me decides they don't want to be around anybody else that thinks differently than they do. I'm not like that. I have friends that I've had for very, very long periods of time, and they will remain my friends. But if you agree or disagree, hey, post your comments on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Our final segment today will be about Governor Ralph Northam. If you don't know who he is, stick around. We'll tell you for sure. And it's a really, really big controversy. After a photo of a person in blackface and one in a Klan outfit surfaced in his 1984 college yearbook, he has faced a growing chorus on both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats, to step down, to resign. So far, he has resisted, and he said the picture in question is not him. He did admit, however, to posing in blackface at a different party, one where he was trying to look like Michael Jackson. That one he did apologize for. Interesting that, to me anyway, interesting that many of the people who are calling for his ouster are Democrats. Democrats who, in my judgment, are looking to immunize themselves against attacks from Trumpist Republicans. Remember that many, many Democrats, and progressives for that matter, have said that Donald Trump is inherently racist, that he has done inherently racist things, said racist things, used racist dog whistles, etc., etc. This is the perfect foil. Here comes this guy, who is a Democrat, who apparently in 1984, when he was in medical school, posed in either in blackface or with a Klan robe. Now, again, to be fair, he says, that's not me. I didn't do this. How then did it end up on his yearbook page? See, there's certain things that just don't make sense. If somebody, for example, were to put in my yearbook a picture of me in a baseball uniform, I tell him, you got to get rid of that. I didn't play baseball. All right. So I wonder how it is that these folks somehow managed to do this and now say that wasn't me. And, you know, maybe he didn't remember from 1984. That was like 35 years ago. Is it that far back? Yeah, 35 years ago. So maybe he didn't remember it was there. But I'll tell you what, in 1984, even in 1894, if it had been me and I was somebody who had a problem with people posing in blackface, I would have objected to having that picture in my yearbook. Not just someone in blackface, but a guy in blackface standing next to another guy in a Klan robe. I mean, how much more blatantly racist can you get? Now, when I first heard about this, and maybe it was just, you know, reading a little bit of his backstory, I thought, well, maybe I could give Ralph Northam the benefit of the doubt. But while this is all going on, and I thought about this even further, while this is happening, it's interesting to look at the 20th century history of blackface. Now, I'm saying this knowing that blackface, in fact, started back in the 1830s somewhere. Whether it was the 1830s or the 1930s, blackface was always used as a way to entertain white people by caricaturing black people. That's what blackface was for. Now, there was a time further down the road when it was filmed where they would have whites dressing in blackface rather than hiring black actors to play black people. I'm very aware of that history. But the fact is that if you go back and look at blackface, you see that in many cases, it came with people shuffling the way they thought black people shuffled, speaking the way they thought black people spoke. There was a lot more to this than just finding some shoe polish or whatever they used to blacken up their faces. It was a way to reinforce white supremacy every time it was used. Just like lynching, although lynching was a far greater consequence, obviously. But these were the tools that white supremacists used to reinforce their beliefs and reinforce their role by making light of black people, by making it as though black people were worthy of being caricatured, worthy of being denigrated, worthy of being looked at as less than human. That's what this was all about. No matter how you want to dress it up. And I find it fascinating that in 2019, suddenly blackface is this thing that apparently should never have happened. So if that's the case, because obviously, you know, people calling on a sitting governor to resign because he posed in blackface means that it never should have happened, period. Not just his picture, but blackface in general. And I love this sort of hindsight in looking at this and saying, well, okay, we know it was wrong, and now we're going to punish people for it. And obviously the people who started it and perpetuated it over the years aren't around to be punished for it. But the fact of the matter is, and we see this over and over again. You see Megyn Kelly, for example, defend the use of blackface in Halloween costumes. You see other people dress up in blackface at sporting events, for God's sake, at sporting events. Why is this all happening? Is it now in 2019, no matter what happens to Ralph Northam, is it in 2019 or was it in 1984 a subtle way of reinforcing white supremacy? Because see, when it started, it wasn't subtle. It was overt. It was in your face. It was, oh yeah, we're better than you. And look at you, this is why. And believe me, blackface tore at the psyche, the collective psyche of Black America in ways that were very, very obvious in some cases. And the larger America cared not one whit about it. They didn't care whether blackface insulted Black people. They didn't care. And that history has largely been pushed aside, buried, etc., to the point that in the late 20th and early 21st centuries, blackface, you could make an argument, has made a comeback. That's the problem. That's the issue. That is what has to be dealt with by American society. Whether Ralph Northam stays around as governor of Virginia, to me, is actually secondary. The crucial issue here is at what point do you really start to examine, acknowledge, and therefore bury these kinds of racist, white supremacist stereotypes? Now, there are going to be people, and I've heard a lot of this too, particularly from conservative folks. Again, people I know, people I'm friendly with. Well, how far back are you going to go in a person's life to dig up dirt on them? And they will use, for example, Brett Kavanaugh as an example of that. You know, they went back to high school. Of course, Brett Kavanaugh didn't pay any price for it. Brett Kavanaugh's on the Supreme Court. But people, when they're young, do some crazy stuff. I know I did. I wouldn't want people to dig too far into my past. But then I'm not looking to become a public figure on that level. You know, I don't really care at this time in my life how far back people want to dig into my past to say I'm somehow not credible because when I was in high school, I did A, B, and C. Or when I was in college, I did A, B, and C. Or after I grew up to adulthood, I did A, B, and C. There's a lot. Everybody has done things that they're not necessarily proud of. And hey, take a number. I'm number one. But at some point, you do have to be accountable, especially if you're an elected official. And the more I look at this, the less I'm willing to give Governor Ralph Northam the benefit of the doubt. The benefit to say, well, okay, well, maybe it wasn't him. Because ironically enough, I made that argument just the other day. That, like, hey, maybe it's not Ralph Northam. If he says it's not him, maybe it isn't. But there's just a hint of loss of credibility there. How do you have this in your yearbook? He said he didn't buy the yearbook, so maybe he never saw it. But the bottom line is, I assume he had friends in college, in medical school, who would have said to him, hey, Ralph, man, look at this. It's you in blackface and in somebody in a Klan uniform. I just get a sense that that's not totally credible. Now, again, I could be wrong, but the fact of the matter is, if you go over the history of blackface in this country, and by the way, not just blackface, but white supremacy in the context of some of the highest elected officials in the land. Woodrow Wilson, prime example. And I believe Princeton University has tried to distance themselves from Woodrow Wilson, who was probably one of the best known Princetonians ever. Woodrow Wilson praised publicly the racist film Birth of a Nation. He refused to sign an anti-lynching bill, which to me says he didn't care if black people got lynched. It was something that, and he was at the same time an arch segregationist. So as far as I'm concerned, you know, hey, pox on him. But to me, the central question becomes, how do you start to examine that? See, because kids don't learn about a lot of this stuff. They really don't. And I believe that a lot of children have been conditioned over time. I'm not going to say brainwashed because they weren't brainwashed, but they have been conditioned over time not to take seriously or care much about anything that went on before them. So they live in the present. They look toward the future, but they're not particularly concerned about what happened in the past. And that can be dangerous. I say it can be dangerous when you see high school kids in a sports arena or in a gymnasium dressed up in blackface. And not only do they dress up in blackface, they put Afro wigs on, just in case you don't know who they were trying to slur, who they were trying to denigrate. So for me, you know, you forget about your past at your peril. America's difficulty over time has always been, in my judgment, its refusal to acknowledge its past. It's acknowledged it to some small extent, but not to the extent it needs to be acknowledged. And when I say that, I'm saying there has to be a point at which we examine some of these open wounds of racism and say, okay, this is what it is, this is what it's done, and this is why it should never, ever, ever happen again. And Ralph Northam is just one small example of an opportunity to do that. Sadly, I'm not at all certain it's going to happen. America has a startling ability to dodge and play dodgeball with questions and issues pertaining to race. It's not something we want to deal with. It's not something that we think is important or necessary to deal with. We may say, you know, we're anti-racist, or racism is wrong, or racism bad. But we're not really prepared, you know, at times when people call out racism, folks start screaming about political correctness. Well, gee, what's wrong with you? You're all too thin-skinned. Y'all need to get over it. How many times have you heard people refer to black people and say they just need to get over it? They need to get over racism. They need to get over, they don't say need to get over white supremacy because they don't see that as a black problem, ironically enough. There is going to come a time when America is going to have a reckoning, a truth and reconciliation with its past racism. It's not going to make the country perfect, but I would submit to you that it would make the country better. And isn't that what this really is all about? Making America just a little, I mean, I'm not talking about making America great. I'm saying making America better. That's something I believe we can do. That's something I believe we ought to strive for, and we ought to pass on to our children the legacy of our efforts to make America a better place. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. The executive producer of The Intersection is Kim Jack Riley. And again, if you want to like what I'm doing, or if you want updates, like my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Send me an email at mark@markrileymedia.com. If you've got a topic you want me to cover, email me, mark@markrileymedia.com. Whether you agree or disagree, let's have that conversation. Post your comments on my Facebook page at Mark Riley Media. Till we meet again, Be well.